The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
I'll tell you a little bit about what's happening here today, since it's different. Today is the day that here at IMC we're celebrating Vesak. Vesak is a Buddhist celebration of the Buddha's birth, his death, and his enlightenment. And it's usually the one Buddhist celebration we do every year here. And I'll talk about it a little bit, I'll give a little talk. And then at 10:30, the various youth programs we have at IMC will join us up here for, they'll bring the baby Buddha's being born out there under the redwood tree. And they'll bring the baby Buddha in here. Then afterwards, there's going to be a potluck for the families. All the youth program and their parents and stuff are staying behind. There are going to be more youth programs starting at 11:30 or so, but there's a potluck for them. For those of you who are not part of that, if you'd like, the teen program that we have, for the second year in a row now, has put on a bake sale. They do that. They've done it for, as a benefit for Doctors Without Borders, and they'll be outside on our deck with a table there set up with all kinds of goods that they baked. And then, if you would like to make an offering for what they have baked, that offering will go to Doctors Without Borders. So probably what it means is that we shouldn't do a lot of lingering in here afterwards, but rather linger outside in the deck in the graveled kind of garden area, so that it can get set up here for the kids who come in and do their potluck and program. So today we're celebrating the Buddha, remembering the Buddha, the Buddha's birth, his enlightenment, and his death. And I like it that these three events of his life are all rolled up and celebrated the same day, because they relate to each other. And understanding how they relate, seeing how they relate to each other, understanding them in context, I think adds meaning to each of them. The idea that he was born and he died makes the Buddha a human being, just like you. You were born and someday you'll die. And then sandwiched between these two monumental events is his awakening. And his awakening is a response to this world that we live in, the world of birth and death. And it's his kind of response, his solution, his way of coming to peace, or finding some profound experience of peace, liberation, in this human condition that we find ourselves in. And so enlightenment, awakening, is not meant to be something separate from the human condition, but it's understood within the human condition as a possibility that we all have, we all share, the possibility of somehow setting the mind, setting the heart, setting the body free. Traditional story of the Buddha tells the story of a person who went on a quest for liberation after his encounter with sickness, old age, and death. And he was looking for some kind of solution to these existential issues. And he tried the various religious practices that were available for him at his time in ancient India, including a lot of ascetic practices. At some point, the peak of his ascetic period, he remembered a story, or remembered an event from when he was 6 or 7 years old, where his parents were out doing the ceremonial spring plowing, of the first plowing of the season. And as a six-year-old, he wasn't really part of the ceremony. So he was left on the edge of the field underneath a rose apple tree, kind of happily forgotten. And everybody's out there kind of doing their ceremony stuff. And he settled into a deep state of well-being, of joy, just sitting there, not particularly trying to do anything, attaining anything, nothing to prove, no one to relate to, nothing to accomplish, just sat and just entered into a state of concentration, stillness. And some children, maybe some of you as children, have memories of states of well-being that you had as children. I remember when I first started meditating a lot, I remembered as I was meditating and kind of getting into kind of stillness or quiet or peace of meditation, I remember this experience I had going to bed at night when I was, 8, 9 years old. And I called it, it's a strange name, and I call it the corner of the pillow experience. And there was a feeling of kind of fullness and presence and peace that kind of would well up in my chest as I laid there and just felt like everything was good, kind of feeling. And I'd forgotten about it until I started meditating. And it was one of those recovered memories. so something about what was happening in meditation touched that place that I had as a child. So the Buddha had this memory from when he was a kid. And he thought, oh, perhaps that way of being, that sense of presence and stillness and letting go and, well, joy, maybe that's a way forward in this quest I have to understand these issues of sickness, old age, and death. And so with that, he went into meditation, went back into that state, and then committed himself to follow that path as far as it would go and hopefully become awakened or liberated. And so it's very common in Buddhist temples and centers to have a statue of the Buddha meditating, and as we have here. And usually it's meant to depict him meditating on the night of his enlightenment. The statues that we have, the image we have of the Buddha, are meant. It's meant also to be quite symbolic, and it's interesting to look at the symbolism of this body. First, he's generally taken to be sitting on the ground, so on the earth, grounded. He's also sitting in a very balanced way. Sitting cross-legged is a very balanced, supportive way of sitting. His belly is usually taken, his lower body, his lower torso, is usually depicted as being relaxed. So he has a relaxed support for the upper torso. His chest, the Buddha's chest in these statues, is meant to have, to take the lion's pose. It's meant to have be one that's not puffed up, but expresses confidence. So a confidence pose on top of this relaxed support of the lower body. So he's a man, a person who's confident. The spine is upright. And the idea of being upright and alert, he isn't withdrawn, he isn't receding. He's also not going into the world in an active kind of way either, but he's fully planted in this world and standing upright in it. His eyes, usually in these kinds of statues, are not closed. Even though we sit with meditation with our eyes closed, he sits with his eyes kind of half open, and that's supposed to symbolize that he's not separated himself from the world. He's aware of the world. He's connected to the world with his eyes and sees what's going on. It's not shutting the eyes, shutting the world out, that the liberation happens. Then also he's supposed to have usually a little smile. It's called a half smile, and in that he has this kind of sense of peace and well-being and joy that comes from his liberation, his freedom. There's something usually very still about the statue. He's sitting upright, alert, and also very still. I liken it to the stillness of a candle flame, which when there's no wind at all, the candle flame doesn't flicker. But you think the candle flame is actually a very dynamic thing. You know, it's but from a distance, from outside, it looks like it's completely unwavering. But inside, it's full of life and vitality. So the Buddha has this wonderful combination of being energized and present, but also completely still. And there's a wonderful dynamic between presence and stillness. They're almost like two sides of the same coin. If you bring your full presence to whatever you're doing, chances are that something about you will also become very still. If you bring a complete stillness, find a real healthy kind of stillness, you'll probably also find yourself very present for what's going on. A stillness which withdraws from experience, from awareness, is probably not real stillness. And when I worked at Green's restaurant, I was a fast order cook kind of at the restaurant, and I'd spent a few years in Buddhist monasteries up until that time, and so I brought my sense of practice to working in this very fast kitchen, and I learned that it's possible to be, if you're fully present for what you're doing, it's possible to do things very fast and become very still. At the end of my shift, I would feel stiller than when I came to begin the day. I know it's possible to do a lot like that and get frazzled and feel exhausted, but I would actually feel very still and very present, very calm, from my full presence to what I was doing. So the Buddha discovered this capacity for presence and this capacity for stillness. The combination of those then also led him to see very deeply into the conditioned nature of the mind, the heart. And one of the things he saw was he saw the place where the genesis or the tricks of the mind that bring on suffering, how we contract, how we end up hating or being afraid or caught up in greed or lust. He saw the movements of the mind, and he saw that the responsibility for those movements of the mind, movements of the heart, lie in us. So it is not a matter of looking externally for someone to solve these issues for us, as if the world out there can provide it. If we just, if California can just figure out its tax system, figure out its finances, then I'm sure I'll be happy. It's rather for some real happiness, real liberation, some real capacity to deal with these difficult life issues that all of us are dealing with. The Buddha says, take a mirror to yourself and see what I saw. And what he saw is that if the mind moves to hold on to anything, to cling to anything, to resist anything, that mind will suffer. And if you let go of that clinging, that suffering will go away. That suffering does not arise independent, spontaneously, by itself. It's not forced on us by the situations of the world, but rather involves some response within ourselves in relation to what's happening. The Buddha attained his awakening as an adult, not as a child. As an adult, the idea of stepping back and looking deeply at your own responsive activities of your mind, the reactive activities of the mind, and learning to look at it, to be present for it, to be very still for it, and see that you don't have to pick things up, you don't have to get involved. You can create infinite space around what arises. You can have hate arise in your mind, and you can step back from it and not have to do anything about it. You don't have to pick it up, you don't have to push it away, but rather you can create a lot of, in a sense, a lot of space in the mind so it's there without any power for you. There can be strong desire or strong fear. When there's still presence that meets that fear and that desire, it's possible, again, in a sense, to have a lot of space around it. And in that space, you realize that those experiences of fear, of hate, and desire don't define who I am. I don't have to define myself by it. I don't have to believe it. I don't have to act on it. I can be free of it, free of living by it, or being pushed around by it. And that capacity to be free, to have life go through us, and to step back and be free, brings a phenomenal feeling of happiness. The Buddha said, a watched mind brings happiness. A watched mind is happy. Not to be a voyeur, but rather to have this wonderful combination of presence, of stillness, of clear seeing of what is, that where those all those things come together, and we see, oh, this is how my mind works, and I don't have to act on that, those movements of the mind that cause me suffering, and I can act on those movements of the mind that bring happiness. I like to think that the large chest of the Buddha not only expresses confidence, but also expresses his great compassion and his great love, this huge heart that he has. And so as the mind becomes still, present, that the heart also becomes quite full. And the full heart is one that hopefully is big enough and large enough that we can hold the whole world in our hearts. That our life is not one of withdrawal, and not one of just what's in it for myself, but rather it's a way of meeting the world, responding to the world, living in this world, so that how we live is supportive and helpful for others. So here we are, 2,500 years after the Buddha, still referring back to the Buddha and what his awakening was as a source of inspiration and meaning for us. It could be said that none of us, we wouldn't be together here as a group of people unless unless it was for the Buddha. We share that here, that brings this particular constellation of people together. If he hadn't lived, some of us would be at the beach today, and some of us would be, I don't know, doing other things. And I think that the distance between us and the Buddha is not that great. In the Zen tradition where I studied in, I was given what's called Dharma transmission, where you're supposed to kind of transmitted the Dharma from your teacher, and your teacher was transmitted from his or her teacher and back through the generations. And I was given a document that shows the genealogy all the way back to the Buddha. Now, some of it's mythological, but a lot of it's not. And but it shows about 92 or 93 people. And that's about how many people we have here at IMC today. So if you lined up, all of us, we would get back to the Buddha. And I think that makes it pretty close to me. Another way to figure out, maybe it's a little bit unusual, but silly, is you ever done the exercise where you figured out how many ancestors you've had, maybe in the 50 generations back? The way that things grow exponentially, two parents and four grandparents and eight grandparents, it goes back and back and back. After 50 generations, I think you get something like 70 trillion ancestors, which doesn't work. There couldn't have been that many people back then. So somehow we must have shared a lot of similar ancestors. We must have had a lot of commonality in our family lineages. And I think, at some point we were all, go back far enough and we're all related to each other. We're all related to the Buddha. We're all related to each other in our humanity. And I like to think of the Buddha as someone who reminds us that liberation comes hand in hand with a compassionate feeling of the connection that we all have. So one of the things that we do to remember the connection between the Buddha and all of us and the connection of the heart and remind us that that is part of our practice. We don't practice separate from all that. There's a tradition in Buddhism to take a red cord, and it has to be a very special cord that's somehow been specially infused. But this cord that I have here has not been infused with anything yet, except for what they have at Michael's. The children right now are getting ready out in their parking lot, and they're preparing themselves to come in here, and they're getting the baby Buddha ready, and they're going to bring it in here, and then we'll do a little ritual chanting. But we have to get ourselves ready for the kids to come in. So what we're going to do is take this cord and weave it in and out and around and about so everyone is holding it. Or if not everyone, then the tradition, because not everyone sometimes can hold it, that he has to have it go around the perimeter. And the perimeter somehow holds us all. And then when it comes, it goes all the way around and it comes back, and then it comes back and it make a loop and goes back to the Buddha. So if you could take this and hold on to a piece of it and then just pass it around, and we'll see how that works. And the red is supposed to be symbolic of the Buddha's robes, and that we all connected to. The other thing I want to say is that the statue in the front of the Buddha is also the Buddha, and it's the Buddha on the night of passing away. He passed away at the age of 80 or 81 years old, and he died quite peacefully. There's an account of him dying outdoors. He laid himself down underneath two sal trees, and these trees, they say, bloomed out of season, and the blossoms were quite fragrant, and the blossoms kind of sent their petals falling down all around him. Very nice and idyllic. But the way that the Buddhists like to remember the death of the Buddha is that he died peacefully. And I think that this is very meaningful, that here death is often one of the things that most frightens people, most troubles people, many people. Or people's relationship to death is often quite troubled, or their relationship to life in relationship to death can be quite troubled. And here's a man who faced his death knowing he was dying, and had attained a level of peace, had attained, kind of resolved some of the key issues of his life, and so he was able to just lay down. And he entered into meditation, and then as he went through his different meditation states, at some point in a particular meditation state, I suppose he let go. And in that state, he passed away. They say he had been poisoned accidentally. He'd eaten something that shouldn't have been eaten. But he was... the accounts of him is that he was quite old and quite frail by the time he died. Usually when people think of the Buddha, they think of this beautiful the statue of the Buddha when he was, 36 years old, kind of in a peak of health and all that. I'll tell you a little bit about what's happening here today, since it's different. Today is the day that here at IMC we're celebrating Vesak. Vesak is the Buddhist celebration of the Buddha's birth, his death, and his enlightenment. And it's usually the one Buddhist celebration we do every year here. And I'll talk about a little bit, I'll give a little talk. And then at 10:30, the various youth programs we have at IMC will join us up here for, they'll bring the baby Buddha's being born out there under the redwood tree. And they'll bring the baby Buddha in here. Then afterwards, there's going to be a potluck for the families. All the youth program and their parents and stuff are staying behind. There are going to be more youth programs starting at 11:30 or so, but there's a potluck for them. For those of you who are not part of that, if you'd like, the teen program that we have, for the second year in a row now, has put on a bake sale. They do that. They've done it as a benefit for Doctors Without Borders, and they'll be outside on our deck with a table there set up with all kinds of goods that they baked. And then, if you would like to make an offering for what they have baked, that offering will go to Doctors Without Borders. So probably what it means is that we shouldn't do a lot of lingering in here. afterwards, but rather linger outside in the deck, in the graveled kind of garden area, so that it can get set up here for the kids who come in and do their potluck and program. Okay. So, and also the statue of him, you know, lying down there. You know, he doesn't look like he's 80 years old, but some of the depictions of him have him, he was stooped over and all wrinkled, and he had a bad back. And he described himself, it was very hard for him to kind of keep going in his frail old age, but he could use his meditation and his mindfulness to hold it all together. We would like our religious founders to be sterling examples of health and buoyancy and everything. But I think it's very realistic to think of the Buddha 2,500 years ago getting to the ripe old age of 80 and stooped over, wrinkled, and a variety of things. So, if the people who are right here on the floor can move back a little bit or come over here, because we need to have space in here for the procession. And if you can help the kids, make sure they don't trip over the cord if it goes going out through the outer hall there. So welcome everyone, kids and adults and everyone. And we're here to celebrate the Buddha's birthday. And in preparation for you kids coming in here, we took this red cord. You see this red cord? That's hold up the red cord so the kids can see. You see that? And that goes all the way around the whole room here, and it goes all the way back to the Buddha who's holding there. And the red cord is supposed to come from symbolize the love and the generosity and the peace that comes from the Buddha that holds us all here today. And we're going to celebrate that love and that peace and that generosity with our little songs and our chants and with washing the baby Buddha. See, usually when babies are born, one of the first things that happens is they get washed. And so we have this ladle that's inside that bowl of water with the baby Buddha standing there. He's kind of precocious, so he's standing, ready for his shower. And and the idea is that each of us has our own Buddha potential, and that with celebrating the birth of the Buddha, we're celebrating the possibility of cleansing ourselves of all that troubles us, so that we too can be a Buddha. We too can be liberated and free. So, do we want to do your song first, Misha? Or we want to do the maybe do your song first.
I'll do the song first.
Okay. So Misha leads the Dharma Rocks program here for the 3rd to 8th graders. So, you want to go ahead.
Some of you have a copy, and I'm sorry I didn't think to make that many. So hopefully some of you can share. It's a very simple tune. The kids sort of know it. They don't know much more than we do. So please feel free to join in. I'm going to just sing the first verse along so that you get the tune. It is really a very simple tune. And then if you're nearby someone who's got a copy, you'll be able to plug in words. So the kids listen up closely. Okay. A blade of rice, a pine cone, a twig upon the tree, the sky above my mother's bars, they're all a part of me. Okay, so Kit, let's start from the top. A blade of grass, a pine cone, a twig upon the tree, the sky above my mother's love, they're all a part of me. A grain of sand, a butterfly, a robin flying free, a newborn calf my father's left, they're so I'll sing that, and then we can sing it together.
Celebration like this is remembering the Buddha and expressing our gratitude and appreciation and the sense of support we get from the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha. And so is a chanting of what's called the refuges. So I'm going to teach, I think, the simple refuge chant in Pali, the ancient language. And for the kids, this will be new. And then after I do this chant with all of you, then the kids are going to teach the grown-up to chant. Does that seem okay? So, it starts off by just remembering the Buddha, and then we do the refuges. So, I'll do one word, and you can repeat after me. And the words are namo, which means like hail, or yay, or... tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa, and it's hail to the worthy one, the perfectly self-enlightened one. So repeat after me. Namo
namo
tassa
tassa
bhagavato
bhagavato
arahato samma sambuddhassa
sambuddhassa
namo
namo
tassa
tassa
bhagavato
bhagavato
arahato
arahato
samma sambuddhassa
sambuddhassa
namo
tassa
bhagavato
bhagavato
arahato
arahato
samma sambuddhassa
sambuddhassa
buddham Saranam
Gacchami
Dhammam Saranam
Gacchami
Sangam
Saranam
Gacchami. So this is saying Buddha, Saranam means refuge, and Gacchami means to go or to walk into refuge, to walk for refuge with the Buddha. And then the usual way to do it is you do it three times, because the first time we didn't quite get the idea, and the second time we're kind of like getting oriented, and the third time we really kind of can connect to it. So we add this word dutiyampi, which means for the second time, and then tatiyampi for a third time. So dutiyampi
buddham
saranam
Gacchami.
Dutiyampi dhammam saranam
Gacchami.
Dutiyampi sangam saranam
Gacchami.
Tatiyampi buddham saranam
Gacchami.
Tatiyampi dhammam
saranam
Gacchami. Tatiyampi sangam saranam
Gacchami.
So, and then we have a chant, and the kids will teach it to you. It's the first word. What's the first word of sub? When you chant outside, can you say it? Sabe. And the second word? Sata. And the third word? Suki. And the third word? Hontu. So sabe means all in the ancient Pali language. Sata means being. And suki means happy. And hontu means may they be. So may all beings be happy, is the chant. And so it goes. I'll do one. First, kids and I will do one word, and you guys, the grown-ups, can repeat to see if you can get it. So ready? So
sabe,
sabe,
sata,
sata,
suki.
Hontu. Guys did pretty well. So now we'll do a whole line up. The kids and us will do the whole line, and then after we do the line, you guys can say the lines. So,
sabe sata suki hontu.
Again,
sabe sata suki hontu, sabe sata suki hontu, sabe sata suki hontu.
Okay, so you got it now. So now two things are going to happen here. One is that we're going to keep chanting it a little bit, and then we're going to pause after each line, And then maybe first the kids, and after maybe if some kids want to do it, after the kids, some of the grown-ups can evoke some category of beings that we would like to send our loving kindness to, our well-wishing to. So it could be, you know, it could be anything. It could be all of us here. It could be all animals. It could be all frogs. It could be all, you know, grandparents or whatever. And then we'll chant, and then we'll do the evoke something. That's the first thing. The second thing is would you like to volunteer to do something? Do you see sitting next to me? So what it is, this water here was here while we were all meditating. So because it was here while we were meditating, it's associated with all the goodness and peace and happiness and joy and love which was circulating around this room before. So it's very special water. And do you feel like you want to go around the room while we're chanting and sprinkle it on people? Because it kind of blesses them. It kind of makes them feel good. You want to do that? Or someone else? You want to do it? No? Not so sure. You want to do it? Okay. So you go out there and bless everyone with all that goodness. And then we can chant. So... Sabe sata suki hontu. So the kids have.
Sata suki hontu.
Let's see. Let's wait a minute here. Wait. You're going too fast. So who? What category? So the kids have some category. We want to send loving kindness to? So all parents, sabe sata suki hontu. Then wait, which ones? Then all pets, sabe sata suki hontu. Moms, sabe sata suki hontu. So how about the grown-ups? Do you have anybody you want to evoke? Any categories of beings? Thank you.
All Dharma teachers.
Sabe sata suki hontu.
All high school students.
Sabe sata suki hontu.
Homeless.
All homeless people. Sabe sata suki hontu.
All sick people, ill people.
Sabe sata suki hontu.
All people looking for work?
All people looking for work. Sabe sata suki hontu.
All unhappy people.
Sabe sata suki hontu.
Aung San Suu Kyi and the people of Burma.
Sabe sata suki hontu.
The people of Tibet.
Sabe sata suki hontu.
All
soldiers and veterans.
Sabe sata suki hontu.
All children.
Sabe sata suki hontu.
Leaders of all nations.
Sabe sata suki hontu.
All animals.
Sabe sata suki hontu.
All political prisoners.
Sabe sata suki hontu.
All those filled with hatred.
All people filled with hatred.
Sabe sata suki hontu.
All refugees.
Sabe sata suki hontu.
All endangered species.
Sabe sata suki hontu.
May all the beings that we share this planet with, may they all be happy.
Sabe sata suki hontu.
And then finally, there cannot be a Buddhist celebration or ceremony without a final act, which is called dedication of merit. And what this dedication of merit means, it's usually done kind of in a formulaic ritual way, and people don't even know what they're doing, really. But what it means is, ideally you would take all the goodness, all the benefits that somehow have been derived from the event that you've been part of, your practice, the activity, the celebration, whatever. Whatever way that you've benefited. And perhaps you came and meditated here today and you're a little bit calmer. Perhaps you're a little bit more insightful. Maybe you're a little bit more less reactive. Maybe you're more compassionate. Maybe you're happier. Maybe you leave here ready to wish the people that you encounter that they be happy. May all beings be happy. So whatever way you've benefited, you consider what that benefit might be. And then you also consider how, in practical, real ways, and in indirect ways, can the benefit that I've derived serve to be a benefit for others. So it's not just for myself, but it's also to serve and better the world that we're in. So there's an act of consideration, an act of reflection, of imagination, to think, how is it when I leave here and get in my car to drive away, how is it that when I'm on the freeway, how can my practice here be support to the people that I encounter on the freeway, so that perhaps I'm more generous as a driver, back in my neighborhoods with my families or places of work. So that act of reflection is a very important part of Buddhist practice, so that we feel there's a connection between our practice and others. So for whatever benefit and merit that has come from our practice together, we dedicate it for the welfare and happiness of all beings everywhere. May all beings be happy. And now, there's a ladle in here. And if you want to come and wash the baby Buddha, first the kids, if you want to wash the Buddha, you can do that. It's maybe one time, one ladle full of water. And thank you all. Timing is perfect for the phone. Remember, there's a wonderful bake sale outside on our deck. And thank you for coming.